Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, it's Tuesday, the 27th of July, 2021, a day early this week, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, who edits our online daily news. Hi there, Phil.
Hello, David. Morning. How are things down in Devon?
A little bit wet, actually. It's been absolutely boiling the last few days. We've had a really heavy shower, which is great because I laid a load of turf, 45 square metres of turf at the weekend.
That saves you a job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes, save my water bill as well. So that's entirely good. So I'm in a good mood. Anyway, we've got quite an interesting programme of discussions today. One big story, which I know that you have been delving into and it really caught my attention, was this story of Cleveland Bridge, one of the best known steelwork fabricators in the UK, actually one of the world's most famous steelwork fabricators. They've done some fantastic work all over the world. Is now in administration. Sadly, it was. Well, you did the story, Phil. So you tell us what the details are. Their owner doesn't seem very interested in them anymore. Is that basically the nub of it? Oh.
To be honest, I don't know enough detail about it. I looked at they filed their accounts for 2019 at the end of March this year. And then they're saying, the directors say they have a reasonable expectation that the company's got adequate resources to continue in operation for the foreseeable future. They've got cash flow, 48 million, debts of only 17 million, which is still high, yeah. But you know, not too bad. Turned over 48 million, made a modest pre-tax loss of $500,000, just under. So we didn't see this crisis coming.
No, not at all. And they've got a full order book as well, haven't they?
Pretty much, I think. Yeah. So whether it's some cunning ploy from the Saudi sheikh who owns the company just to shake off UK debt and buy it back or make it put into better shape to sell it. And, I hope it's not going to disappear. It's too big a name, too good a company.
It is indeed.
But we've got someone here who knows much more about the history of the company, haven't we? You can tell us all about it.
We have. Yes. So welcome our guest for this week, Helena Russell, who is a freelance journalist, a bridge specialist, something of a bridge specialist, and a regular contributor to the Construction Index magazine, I'm pleased to say. A lot of people in the industry will know Helena. She's a bit like us. She's been writing about construction for a very long time. And in fact, you wrote the book on Cleveland Bridge, didn't you, Helena? Welcome to the podcast.
That's right. Thank you very much. Yes, I was commissioned to write this for the 125th anniversary of the company, which it was published in 2002. So obviously it's been around for quite a long time.
Mm. And have you followed the fortunes of the company since then? Presumably you have.
Only really in the same way as everybody else. I mean, I come across them occasionally when they're working on projects, and I've written about some of the things that they've done since then. Mm. But I'd not been into it in such detail as I did at the time.
No.
Obviously, that involved going back into their archives quite a long way.
They've got an illustrious history, haven't they, this company? Tell us a little bit about some of the real landmarks that they've created.
Well, they've created a lot of bridges that people will recognise, also a lot of tall buildings and special structures and so on. But as the name suggests, their real speciality has always been bridges. Mm. And a lot of the bridges that you know, people will recognise as landmarks, they've built the decks for them, they've spun the cables for them, they built them as contractors or as part of a contracting joint venture. And they actually started back in the late 1800s when somebody bought, a guy called Henry Dixon, bought a bit of land in Darlington. and decided he was going to set up a company to make steel, to fabricate steel. Mm. Obviously, at the time, there was a great amount of progress going on, the Industrial Revolution, the steel making was a big thing in that area. So they were sort of taking advantage of that.
Darlington was a railway town, though, wasn't it? An early railway town, or Stockton was nearby. Did they start out in railways? Was that part of the origin?
They absolutely did, yes. A lot of their early work was supplying truss bridges to railway companies that were building railways at the time. And the main step that took them into what they became was in the sort of start of the 20th century, when the guy who was in charge decided that they should start doing the actual engineering as well. So instead of just building things to order and sending them out, they would start designing them and you know, actually doing the delivery and the construction themselves.
So name a few of their famous buildings. They were involved with the Shard. That was one of their most recent ones.
Yes, I mean, there's probably the things that people are more familiar with are things like Humber Bridge, mm-hmm. Carquinez Bridge in the US, the Tsing Ma Bridge in Hong Kong. Probably the most well-known one is the Queens Ferry Bridge, which recently opened over the Forth Estuary. So it was the very dramatic triple-towered new bridge crossing the Forth. They provided quite a lot of the steel deck for that, I think. So that was a major contract for that, and that obviously was very recent.
Yeah, well, it's certainly probably the most high-profile bridge built in recent years, isn't it? I mean, it's quite an impressive structure.
I mean, they've become, over the years, they've become a company that's absorbed other companies. So one of the most famous ones was Dorman Long, which was around at about the same time as them, came from a similar background, and that was bought in, I think, the 1980s. So all the sort of portfolio of work that Dorman Long had done was brought in as well. So things like Sydney Harbour Bridge, came into their portfolio. So some of the older ones they've done, they worked on the Tyne Railway Bridge in Newcastle. So that was one of the first big bridges they built. And the Victoria Falls Bridge in Zimbabwe. Oh. And these, they introduced some quite interesting innovations at the time. When they were building the Tyne Bridge, they did use large caissons to sink into the river to build the piers. And they apparently created an airlock system at the top for safety and so on, which they patented. So things like that, they were quite innovative at the time.
Yeah, so innovators as well as just good engineers. But what about ownership? Because, I mean, we mentioned, Phil alluded to the fact that their owner, are they still their owner? It's the Al Rashid Group from Saudi Arabia. But obviously, they weren't always the owners. They've been through a few ownerships, haven't they? They're part of Trafalgar House? Am I right?
Yes, I mean, I actually did, as part of the book that I wrote, I did a timeline which brought together all the different strands, and it's actually quite a complicated document. I remember trying to put it together, and, you know, it was a bit of a complicated process, and it takes up a whole page, which is, and it's still not that easy to read. But they brought together Cleveland Bridge Engineering Company, Dorman Long, Redpath Brown, who were another similar company, and the Teesside Bridge and Engineering Company. And these were all, the two latter ones were bought by Dorman Long. Dorman Long was bought by Cleveland Bridge, but Cleveland Bridge at the time was owned by Cementation. That then became Trafalgar House. Yeah. So in the late sort of, 1900s, there was a lot of change of ownership, and instability.
But Trafalgar House, or their construction interests, were eventually bought by Skanska. But Cleveland Bridge never went to Skanska, did it? It was on its own by then.
No, and it was actually, at the time that I wrote this book, it had been bought partially by a guy called Tony Ray, who was a sort of entrepreneur who'd made money in the construction industry. And I can't remember if he actually bought it himself or whether it was in partnership with a Middle Eastern backer. I've a feeling that was how it was bought, and then he subsequently sold his shares, and I think that's how it came into the ownership of the current owner.
When did that happen? How long have they owned Cleveland Bridge, the Al Rashid Group? Is it recent?
This was there was a management buyout in 2000,
right?
And I think it was around that time, and I think I think Tony Ray was involved then or subsequently. And it was, I think, at that time. So it's probably 20 years or so now.
Oh, right. Oh, that's a lot longer than I thought. I thought they were just sort of very recent investors. Makes you wonder why would a Saudi Arabian company want to buy a British steelwork company? I mean, I know that they're international. They've probably done a lot of work in Saudi Arabia as well. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But I wonder what was in it for them and why they're not interested anymore. Because, as you said, Phil, the company seems to be on a pretty even keel. It's not as if it's about to go under and they want to get out before they go down with it. I mean, do you know if there's any reason given why they're not going to invest anymore?
No, we haven't had that yet.
Right.
But there's got to be a bit of buyer for it. There's got to be. I mean, it's been difficult. We know that it's been difficult for an awful lot of companies the past 18 months. And as you and I have said before, the surprising thing is how few companies have gone into administration in the past 18 months. We know that Cleveland Bridge took advantage of the COVID-19 support, government support programs, you know, the furlough and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
So it's clearly not been without difficulty for them. But I don't accept this is the end of the road for Cleveland Bridge.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I read a report in their local paper, actually, the Northern Echo, which had some interesting news to say. I think there's a crisis meeting on, I think it's Wednesday. We've got until Thursday to find a buyer or an investor, apparently. So that's not very long. But according to one of the administrators, a chap called Martin Pullin from FRP, he says that without significant investment, the business will be wound up, which is obviously a call to action. And according to the GMB union, and this is, I think this is quite interesting, one of their representatives said that one immediate challenge was that the rare high-level skills workers had built up over their careers were highly sought after, and rival firms had already been in touch to offer roles. And I think there's been a little bit of an exodus. I mean, not a mass exodus necessarily, but, you know, these people, you know, they can see the writing on the wall. And if somebody else is offering them a job and they've got, you know, very valuable skills, as this chap says, then they'll be off and you can't blame them. So you might find that whoever buys Cleveland Bridge will just find an empty husk.
Hasn't got any people left.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be nothing there except the goodwill, you know.
Oh, but the brand name's got to be worth a bob or two, though, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
is it still, I imagine so. Helena, are we being jingoistic and overly British thinking it's a great thing? Or does Cleveland Bridge mean as much as we think it does around the world in the world of bridge building?
I think it does still have a great reputation, especially in things like steel deck manufacturing, the specialist sort of, box girder decks that you get for, you know, the major bridges. It's just whether they have the capacity to deliver it these days. You know, there's the bridges that are being built, things like the Çanakkale Bridge in Turkey and so on. They are huge and they require a lot of steel. So it's the manufacturing sort of capacity. Do they have that steel in Cleveland, in Darlington?
So it would seem tragic, really, if a company that isn't actually in financial difficulty at the moment and has 18 months worth of orders on its books were to go under. It would seem a terrible, terrible waste, wouldn't it? So hopefully Thursday will bring some better news. But it's a bit worrying, isn't it? And it's always sad to see a company like this get into trouble.
On the subject of bridges, and Helena, we haven't prepared you for this, but you might like to stick around for our next topic. It's also bridge related. Have you heard that the Golden Gate Bridge has become the world's biggest musical instrument?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, you've heard about that? Good.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think this is possibly a problem that's been experienced elsewhere.
I'll give a bit of background for listeners who haven't read the story. There's a San Francisco musician, guitarist primarily, I think, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, but Nate Mercero or some such?
That's how I pronounce it, yeah.
Who read in the San Francisco Chronicle about how everyone who drove over the bridge and lived near the Golden Gate Bridge was really annoyed at the humming noise that it's been making from the vibrations of the wind acting against it since it had a refurb. And he thought, "Ooh, humming bridges, that sounds like a good idea." So he sat down beside it, got out his guitar and started performing duets alongside the noise of it. And I've had a listen to some of them. It's a bit sort of arty-farty. It's not a sing-along tune.
No.
But would make great soundtrack, great sound instrumental soundtrack to perhaps a mystery film or something. There's definite mood and vibe going on there.
It sounded to me like early Pink Floyd, actually. It's very sort of ambient type of swirly music, lots of harmonics and, you know, that sort of thing.
Ambient's a word, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
But listenable, as long as you're doing something else at the same time, I'd suggest.
Yeah. Helena, do you know any of the technical reasons behind this? Do you know what's actually causing this noise?
They put some new aerodynamic sort of equipment on there, something to reduce the aerodynamics, I think.
It's something to do with the balustrades, I think. They put new balustrades in and they were, I think, narrower, so they presented less wind resistance. But the thing is that now the wind whistles through them like a giant harmonica. In fact, I read a wonderful piece in The Guardian, actually, that it says that the noise has been compared to a ghostly harmonica, chanting monks and a wheezing kazoo. And I think probably all of those and probably other things as well. And also I noticed that he's not the only one, this Nate Mercero isn't the only musician to have cottoned onto this. There's a chap, an electronic music producer who calls himself Mr. Bill, who put something on Twitter. He recorded it and then mixed it into what he described as a soundtrack of existential dread, which which does sound his does sound a little bit more sinister than Nate Mercero's, which is a little bit just relaxing, really. Yeah, but fascinating. And engineers are now working on the project to try and find a solution to it.
I think it's, the Golden Gate Bridge has had an awful lot of work done over the last sort of 20 years in terms of trying to, you know, improve its seismic response and so on. And I think it's probably, you know, there's a lot of things like that happen. They change things to make them lighter or to make them heavier or whatever, and then it has a knock-on effect. And you know, the whole thing about putting up these new balustrades is that you don't really know until you get them on the bridge and in the environment that they're going to be used in what the response is going to be.
Of course, bridges are a bit like that, aren't they? I mean, we had the wobbly bridge, you know, the I can't remember what it's called, the one in the footbridge that from South Bank over the Millennium Bridge, yes. That was obviously quite an embarrassment. And then there was the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which anybody who knows anything about bridges will have seen probably the footage of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge sort of bucking and whipping in the and ultimately collapsing in the wind. And apparently, because I mean, how old is the Golden Gate Bridge? It's quite an old one, isn't it?
26, I think. I can't remember now exactly.
So it's getting on for 100 years old.
Yeah.
So it's been there for a long time. But I think there might be a serious point to this. It's about climate change, that they are now anticipating higher wind speeds in the sort of San Francisco area. And I read that the Golden Gate Bridge is only, I think, built to withstand something like wind speeds of about 65 miles an hour. And now they're trying to upgrade it so that it might be able to withstand 100-mile-an-hour winds. So presumably that explains why they've replaced these balustrades. Well, Helena, thanks very much for joining us today and discussing that with us. It's certainly a very interesting topic and one I know that is close to your heart. So thanks very much.
Helena, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, see you. Bye now.
Talking of strange noises, I had a ping on my phone about 3 weeks ago.
You don't want to hear that.
Telling me that I'd been too close to someone who had been too close to someone or had tested positive for COVID. And while I'm being double jabbed and I took the test and I was fine, I still had to isolate for 10 days. People kept telling me I had to self-isolate, but I didn't know how that was any different from just isolating.
Yeah.
So I just isolated.
I've noticed that as well. Yeah, I know. It's a tautology, really, isn't it?
But that, so that, that's become a big story since my isolation, which fortunately didn't, that meant I couldn't go to the pub and couldn't go to the supermarket, but had enough food in at the time. Essentially, regular listeners will know I work from home, so it didn't stop me doing what I normally do and earning a living. But for many people, it's become a right old nuisance. They call it the pingdemic now. And the construction industry, trade associations and various groups, some are saying that construction industry should be made a special case. Others are saying, well, no, everyone's a special case. If you've got, if you've been double jabbed and you have a test and you haven't got the virus, you shouldn't have to isolate for 10 days. And even Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak briefly agreed with these people and said, "Yeah, we're not going to, just because the health secretary's got COVID and we've been near him, we don't think we should have to isolate either." But then they suddenly realised the optics weren't good. To use one of your favourite terms, David, the optics weren't good, so they ran back indoors and decided to isolate.
Yeah,
but it's become quite a thing. And
it was a fairly typical sort of story, COVID story, isn't it? Because yet again, the government doesn't really know whether it's coming or going.
Well, yeah, there is that. And there's another story this morning. I mean, the story we put up yesterday on Monday morning was that the Construction Leadership Council have called for... I mean, this all changes on August the 16th, which is not that far to wait. But they're saying that it should be, you know, construction should be regarded as key frontline emergency workers along with, you know, police and firefighters and so on, and construction workers should be allowed to carry on working if they're double jabbed and test negative. National Federation of Builders, to their credit, they didn't just say, oh no, construction's a special case, we need special dispensation. They said the whole thing's frankly a mess. Everyone should be allowed to go back to work if they've been double jabbed and they're not, you know, they test negative. But yeah, it's become a big problem. An interesting stat from an organisation called the British Institute of Kitchen, Bedroom and Bathroom Installation, BICBI. They did a survey of 5,000 kitchen and bathroom fitters and found that 47% had to cancel one or more jobs because either they or their customers had been pinged. Not that anyone's got the virus or anyone's ill, but they've just been pinged.
Yeah.
And so, you know, 5,000 jobs have been paused, and having a kitchen fitted, it can be okay. If you're lucky, you might be able to get it done for a couple of grand, but it could be a 20 grand job, some of these kitchen extensions. So we're talking about millions of pounds worth of work being certainly stalled,
put on hold,
postponed, on hold.
It is. I mean, it seems especially unfair when you consider that come the 16th of August the rules will change again, and that you know, all the restrictions will be lifted. I mean, also, not everybody has the app. I don't have the app on my phone, so it's a bit hit and miss. It's random. You were pinged. I might just as easily have been pinged.
Confession time. When I got pinged, I was supposed to be going out to the Yorkshire Dales to visit my mother, and said, "Sorry, Mum, I can't come and see you. I've been pinged." Said, "Well, what have you got it on your phone for?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to be responsible." My mother, the retired magistrate. And so I said, "Well, I'm trying to be responsible." But I confess that after doing my isolation, I did delete it from my phone, so they weren't going to get me again.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've heard stories, and I'm sure that you and many of our listeners have heard stories, again, of people, for example, sitting in traffic, subsequently getting pinged because they've been within a few metres of somebody in a neighbouring car who has tested positive, and even people living in terraced houses being pinged because their neighbours, you know, being pinged through the wall.
Snot and cardboard blocks of flats that people live in, where you can hear the people using the facilities in the next door apartment.
Yeah.
They're getting pinged left, right and centre, though, as I understand it.
It is ridiculous. I suppose it was a good idea when they introduced it, but it does seem to have got out of hand. And I think that probably patience on a general level is wearing thin now. You know, the end seems to be in sight. At least I think that's
the way. You reckon?
Well, I think a lot of people are thinking in those terms. You know, August the 16th, you know, hooray, you know, the final restrictions will be lifted. And so they're focused on that. And everybody thinks, well, you know, 3 weeks isn't going to make a hell of a lot of difference one way or the other, are they? And I think that a lot of people, especially people like you or I perhaps, who don't come into contact with very many people on a daily basis, are probably inclined to be a little bit more relaxed and perhaps dismissive of the whole issue. I mean, my daughter, for example, and I don't mention my daughter in every podcast, but living in London, travelling to work on the tube, clearly is far more concerned because she's coming into close contact with several hundred, possibly thousands of people every day, and there is a real risk of contracting the virus in under those circumstances.
Okay, well, that's interesting because that goes against what I was saying the other week, where I thought that the younger people were perhaps more relaxed. And the statistic I read today that only 50% of them are wearing masks routinely around the place now. They're quicker to shed their masks and quicker to get back to office and so on. And I thought it was us fuddy-duddies.
Sure, but I mean, I think that's partly because, well, people under the age of about 25 think they're indestructible anyway. And so, you know, aren't that bothered. And, you know, they've heard anecdotally that people in their age group tend not to get COVID as acutely as older people, like you or I, for example. And so probably think that they're less vulnerable. But then the other side of the coin is that the incidence of infection, I think, if I'm correct, again, it's only anecdotal evidence that I've got, is that it's spreading more quickly in people of that age group. So it's a sort of a, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, I think.
But that sort of seems to be the, I admit, a year ago, I was reading the newspapers thoroughly and listening to the Chris Whitty briefings whenever he came on telly and really keeping on top of it. And as you suggest, we're getting a bit tired of it now, and I'm perhaps not following it quite as closely as I once was. But my understanding is that while cases are still, I think they are now slowing, but last week they were still rising, the deaths and hospitalizations, the bad end of the worst end of it is not as bad as it has been. But I can't help feeling that come the autumn, we're going to be having these daily briefings again, and there's going to be some. I don't think we're done with lockdowns, I fear.
Well, no, and I think you're probably right, because of course, you know, we'll be entering the flu season, and everybody, I'm sure, has been hearing the doommongers on the radio and television saying, well, you know, we've been sheltered from not just COVID, but from flu by wearing masks and socially keeping our distance from other people. So we're all a little bit vulnerable to the influenza bug as well as the COVID bug. So when the weather turns nasty again, we're all going to get hit.
So the message is, have fun now while you can.
Yes.
which is why we're doing this podcast a day early, because I'm off on my holes in about 2 hours' time.
And where are you going?
I'm going to Northern Ireland.
Oh, right. Okay. Your wife's home turf.
Yes, we're going to see friends and family over there, driving up to Anglesey and getting the ferry to Dublin. So we're going into the European Union.
Wow.
So that's all quite exciting.
And then hopping back across the border. Lovely. Well, I hope the weather's good for you.
I've been asked to bring sausages.
Somebody's trying to get you into trouble, Phil. That's what's going on there.
I'm not going to do it. I daren't.
You don't want to go in there laden with cooked meat, do you, really? Well, I hope you have a lovely time.
Thank you very much. So, but I will be back in time to do next week's podcast. So
good. I was not looking forward to doing it on my own.
You may yet have to. No, we'll see. All being well. I'll be back safely this time next week.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I better let you get packing.
Thank you very much. And see you next week. Everyone, thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast of the Construction Index. If you want to get in touch, you can find us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. And just about everything we've been talking about today is on theconstructionindex.co.uk. And thank you to our special guest, Helena Russell, the bridges expert. But for this week, from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.